Do you have a setting for like a nice hair, like a bouffant kind of hairdo? Or?
We'll do it in post.
Oh, post, right? Yeah. That's good.
Oh yeah. I always say that to guests, and then last time my phone ended up ringing. I was like,
oh my gosh, it went over like 10 times.
It went over, and I kept thinking like it was like a text, and I kept thinking like, oh, that'll be the last text. Like, yeah. I'll just ignore it, and then it kept texting, and then finally I was like, I gotta shut this off.
Do you know? Have you ever seen Nathan Barlow? He's in Keith's band.
Oh yeah.
He was the singer of Luna Halo, and I think it was maybe his first or second week with us, because he's got all this gear that he created, this kind of instrument where he's almost like a DJ up there, but he's a great guitar player, great singer.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway, his first, we were playing this big festival, like massive crowd, and we keep hearing this. Like coming through the speakers in our ear monitors. We're like, what the hell is that? Over and over, wow. And then he finally realizes, he looks at his computer and realizes he left the...
like one sample on or something.
Or no, like airplane mode or something like that. And so somebody from the audience was taking pictures and sending it to his Instagram, and it was coming up on his computer.
Oh my God.
Through the entire speakers, that sound, you know, that swish sound.
So, oh my God.
He was like, oh man, I'm fired already. His first weekend.
That was his first weekend?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Pretty funny.
That's so funny. No, just keep it going. That's great. God, that's so funny. Wait, so what is the... Because I always see that thing. First of all, what he didn't know is that he probably couldn't get fired because... Who do you get to replace that guy?
No, nobody.
Nobody, right?
Yeah.
But does he do all the tracks, or do you have a guy off stage who does tracks for the show?
Well, now he's on stage, too.
Now that's him.
No.
Or no, that's someone else.
I got another guy who controls the track stuff, who he's also playing percussion. So he's got a big job. But for years, he was just on the side with us. So it's amazing. Like, he was so good at what he does, too, because he, occasionally we'll get a little excited. Keith will get a little excited, and then he'll maybe come in earlier or something like that on a part, and then like we always look around and we can just see this thumb going up, and he just fixes it like that, like just an amazing
so
guy.
What does he do? So he realigns the tracks, or does he play the tracks live, or as it's going,
as it's going, and he's constantly changing things. Like, we're not as track heavy as we were a couple years ago, but you know, a lot of percussion, that kind of stuff, little keyboard things, and yeah, it's a godsend having that dude.
So if Keith comes in early, are you playing to a click, and does he come in early to the click, or sometimes does he just come in early without a click?
Usually to the click, but sometimes, you know, he gets excited. And
I feel like he's like Springsteen in that way.
Yeah,
like he just kind of does it.
He just feels it. And so this guy, Jeff Linsenmeyer is his name, he's just on it, man.
And then the person who's playing the controller that you were just talking about, who had...
That's all live. That's samples. Like, he's hitting samples and doing different things live. He created this instrument, and it's like a big iPad almost, and it's like got these squares on it that has no rhyme or reason. I don't know how he memorizes like what he's hitting, but he's triggering samples live, and so it has to be in time too. So it's not like it's locked into a grid. He has to be like right on it.
And what stuff is he doing? Like sound effects or
tons
or
of different stuff.
Percussion, anything.
Yeah. Tons of different stuff. Stuff that we wouldn't normally play on live instruments.
And
you know?
Is that instrument great because it's so visual when you see it live? Because you could probably do it on just like a little pad or something, but on that it's like a whole thing tilted towards the audience, right? Like, it's almost ridiculous.
Yeah, and but it's touch sensitive, so he can, you know, play it a little softer, a little harder, and then it's a lot like a DJ.
Yeah,
he's an amazing find.
It's fun to watch all you guys play live. That's like one of the fun things. It's like you got him, and you're like, "What the hell is he doing?"
Yeah.
And then you got everyone playing bass and guitars and everything.
Yeah.
It's always we set this up because I saw this video of you guys playing at the airport as a trio.
Yeah.
No tracks there.
No.
And then I made some video about it, and then you commented. And I said, "Jared, you want to come on the podcast?"
Right.
And we set this whole thing up.
I think you were saying like, "Does he do this just because he loves music?"
And I was like, "Why would anyone do this other than?" If he loved it, but if I was Keith Urban, I feel like I would show up all the time at random places and play shows.
I think he wants to.
Yeah,
and we probably will.
How did that come together? Was that something that was like in the works for a long
time,
or that was like last minute? He was like
maybe 2 days before we knew. He called me and just said, "I got this cool idea. I just want us to go in there, walk in there, and just play," because he loves playing, loves it, man, like more than anybody I've ever seen. And so I think his first initial thought was to go into like one of those little bars like Tootsie's that's in the airport and just get up on stage and go. But those were too small. Like they couldn't fit the drums or anything. So they found this little place in Seagate where we had a little stage. And we literally just walked up 2 minutes before the show. We're just saying like, what songs? And so he just writes down multiple options and then he just calls it.
How does he get into the airport? Does he just walk in through the front?
No, they actually brought us in through like a back area, which I'd never seen before. It was very cool, actually. And then afterwards, because he didn't really want anybody to know he was playing.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, he just wanted to be a surprise. So when he walked out, it was a surprise.
So you guys set up, so basically you guys go ahead, you set up. Did you do a sound check or anything, or like what do you guys even do?
No.
You just wing it.
Like, zero sound check.
Yeah.
We just walked up there, plugged in. Because I had to rent a little amp just because my stuff's out on the road because we were actually playing a show that
You don't
night.
Have a little amp around your house? Or no. You don't have like a Fender Rumble or like... You
well,
have,
I think I'm going to now. I talked to the Fender guy. He's getting me one.
Yeah, of course.
No, I don't. I don't, man. I'm not a gear guy at all.
But to me, I think you should have at least an amp that you could plug into and just get some tones, right?
Well, I've learned. That, I'm having it now. So
do like, you ever play at home? Like, do you plug into anything or...
It's funny. With bass, I don't play at home at all. I mean, I've got a Logic setup where I'm, you know, I'll do demos for my songwriting stuff, but I don't tend to practice bass. I just like being in the moment playing live, you know. But yeah, I learned my lesson. I got a little amp coming.
Got a little Fender Rumble.
There will be more
of those. Yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah, you
guarantee
gotta, how can you not have a little rig or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But he just loves playing, man. So he just thought, well, that's a cool idea. He had a new single coming out, I think, on the day before. So we thought, let's just do something to get some kind of fun little, attention. And not really attention, just wanted to do something for people because he loves it. And actually, he told the story back in maybe 93, because that's when I joined him. I went to Australia with him for like 6 months. And, we had this manager, Greg Shaw, who was always coming up with wacky ideas to get us noticed. And so he had us, and we were in a little town called Tamworth, like a little country, little Australian town. And he had us play in the airport. But we actually set up, because we were a trio back then, set up on the baggage claim carousel.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so people would come and, come watch us. We'd be playing. And then all of a sudden, like, we'd hear that, and the red light would come on, and people's bags would come out in front of us, and they'd pick their bags up and leave. And so we did that all day long, man.
So you would think, like, what a great crowd. Everyone's here watching
exactly.
us. But then they're just trying to get their bags.
3 minutes later, they're gone. Yeah.
This is something that's so interesting to me is you moved to Nashville in the early 90s, like 93, you said.
93,
and how old were you, like 21?
20,
or like,
20
like,
when
like
I first 20.
You turned 21. You know, after moving to Nashville.
Yeah.
And then within 6 months, you meet Keith Urban.
Yeah.
And he somehow convinces you to go to Australia for 6 months.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the reason that's weird to me is because I would have thought, you grew up in a small town, West Virginia, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would have thought the whole point was to get to Nashville, and now you're leaving Nashville to go to Australia?
Well, and I was told it was going to be a month. And then we ended up being there for 6 months, just playing nonstop. We had this little car with a trailer on the back, and just went up and down the coast playing every rough bar you could think of. It was great, though. We got good.
And did you feel like when I first came to Nashville in those early days, I felt like you couldn't take me away from this place because I just felt any time I spent not in Nashville, I was falling behind or I wasn't making the connections or I wasn't doing the thing. Like, did you have any of that feeling? Like, oh my, like, what am I doing in Australia? This doesn't align. Now it aligns, but at the time, I feel like I would have been like, what am I doing here? I got to get back to Nashville.
I was so new. I guess I just didn't know any better. I didn't know anything about the music business.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to expect. But I've said this before, like my brother and I and our friend John Dedrick, we all moved here together. And Lee Hendricks, who's the bass player with Eric Church, we all moved here at the same time. And in our tiny little town, we were,
the guys.
We were the guys.
Yeah.
So we were cocky when we moved here. And then we got schooled pretty quick once we got here.
And is that why you thought it seemed like a good idea to go to Australia? How much did he pay you to go to Australia for a month?
Nothing.
And you thought, so why did you think it was worth...
No money.
Why did you think it was worth taking a whole month out of your life? You finally got to Nashville, and now somebody's making you go to Australia for a whole month? It just
That's
seems
funny.
Crazy to me.
I've never thought about that before. the hell was I thinking? I get maybe I was just so impressed with him in his basement. He had a little PA in his basement. Maybe I was just blown away by how good he was.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's wild. Now, there was no pay. There was nothing.
Really? He said, come to Australia to me? Because wasn't the reason that he was going to Australia was because he was getting paid?
Well,
or on gigs?
No. They had to go back because of the visa situation.
Okay.
They could only be in the States for so long.
Yeah.
Then they have to go back. So I guess he went back to play as many shows as he can to try to save some kind of money to come back. But we didn't even know each other. I just met him 2-3 weeks beforehand. And so every guy, like when I first get there, we get picked up by
to Australia, when you first get to Australia.
First arrive. And I'm green. I'm completely.
Have you ever left the country before?
No. I'm a hillbilly still at this point, you know? Country. And so someone picked us up, and then they took me to this couple's house and dropped me off. And so for the whole 6 months, people would, like every 2 weeks, other people would let me stay with them. So there was no money. There was no hotel rooms. And so we all had to stay with different families the whole time. And so I would meet people at a barbecue, and they would say, oh, come stay with me.
And would you have like one suitcase and a base, basically?
Yeah,
and that
was it.
And that was it. Mm-hmm. And did it feel productive? Like, did you feel like you were working towards whatever your goals were? Or to me, I would have been like, what the hell am I doing over here? I gotta get back to Nashville.
Stupid and young. Like, I guess I was stupid and young. I didn't realize there were any major goals at that point. I just, he was so good. The band was so good already.
That was a guiding light.
Yeah, every time we played, we got better and better and better and better. You know, it's not like we went over there and played for big crowds. No one knew him there either. He had a tiny little following, like in Tamworth, that little town I was telling you about. That's like the country music capital. But country was not big there, so he was not known at all. So it wasn't like we were going back home to play
a big
for
homecoming or anything.
No,
and why did he think he should, like, he couldn't find a bass player in Australia? Or did you guys just really connect musically? Like,
we
right
just
away?
Connected. I mean, literally, I played the first song with him. His manager came into O'Charlie's where I was working and brought me a cassette tape with 3 or 4 songs on it, just rough demos. And I learned him, and I showed up at his house, played. We played one song, and he goes, you got a passport, mate? And I went, nope. He goes, well, we got to get one. And so we hurried it up and got it done real fast, and then I went over.
Isn't it funny? Like, sometimes I used to promote shows in Nashville at little clubs, and sometimes band members would nickel and dime over getting paid for these gigs.
Right.
And sometimes band members would just say, oh, I just want to play, or I just want to show up and support this artist.
Yeah.
I always think that's how you know if it's a great artist. If the band members are we'll play for free, that's, you got something there. But if the band members are like, no, you got to pay us, it's probably not a great artist.
Mm-mm. No, and it's long term, it's not a great, if you believe in that artist, it's not a great move to maybe demand all the money up front. Maybe you can kind of come up with them. You know, I've said before, like, I've helped a lot of artists with their shows, and I've put bands together for artists, and I always think, like, you're Michael Jordan, the singer's Michael Jordan, but you need a Scottie Pippen. You need someone right there who's at least one guy in your band who is like a loyal guy who's going to be around with you all the time and makes you better, makes the band better. But to me, it's just long term so much better of a situation, you know, than expecting. Because, you know, what are you going to make at the very beginning? It's not real money, you know?
Yeah.
So might as well take a chance on somebody.
Did you see any money playing with Keith until the second leg when he called you back? There was like a gap in the middle. But when you were with the Ranch, was there any point where you play a gig and would you ever walk away with $500 or $1,000 or anything?
Never.
Or never.
Never.
Over 5 years you toured that with that band,
right? And we got a record deal with Capitol. And then they eventually paid us, or I guess it was part of our deal, each guy got $200 a week, and so that's what we lived on.
Did that feel like a lot back then, or
even
back
then?
That was, you were able to get through.
Yeah.
And wait, where were you living in Nashville? Do you have a place here?
I think I was in a place called Knob Hill Villas in Harding Place. Not great.
Did it feel with the Ranch? You were you toured with that band for 5 years. That was Keith Urban, you, and this guy Peter Clark.
Clark
on drums. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is like by the way, if you're listening to this, you should go back and listen to that first Ranch album because it's awesome. It's actually awesome.
It's awesome.
Why did you guys ever think over 5 years you should get back in the studio and make another album?
Well, the timing of it, we basically, because we played nonstop that 5 years. We were in a van just constantly touring, always playing club shows. When Scott Hendricks, because we were actually signed with Warner Records first, and so we did a lot of recordings with them, but the head brass at the time just got so frustrated with us because we weren't kind of the straight-ahead, typical country that was happening at the time. They would just keep putting us with different producers, and they just got so frustrated. So Scott Hendricks heard us, fell in love, and I think he bought the rights to us for real cheap. I think Warner Brothers just wanted rid of us. And so we did the record, finished it up, and he was planning on, like, I think 98, he was planning on, like, the big push for us. Because he put us out in 97, but nothing was happening. We probably sold 16 records, something like that. Most of those to our family members.
Yeah, right.
And he got fired from Capitol in 98. I think he and Garth had a little something going on. That's pretty public, you know, news back then. So he was gone. So the new guy that came in did not want anything to do with us and just shelved the whole thing.
And so that was the problem. So then you basically said, we have to tour for 5 years. And that was like the only thing you could do.
Yeah, we just had to play. And then we were beating our heads against the wall because we would show up, the label would send... They would send singles to whatever bar we were playing at and hoping, like, because they would give them away for free for 2 weeks before we played, hoping people would show up, and no one ever did, you know. So it was rough. We were touring like crazy, but we would show up and play for 10 people. And occasionally we would get a lucky opening gig, like for Joe Diffie. Brooks and Dunn let us open for them, like two shows. Tim McGraw did a couple shows. So those were our moments where we thought, this is going to be it. And then we'd...
Yeah, wouldn't you play these local shows in town?
Oh, yeah.
And wouldn't Brooks and Dunn be like sitting on the floor watching you guys play?
Yeah. A place called Jack's Guitar Bar. On my Instagram account, Keith found... he was sent... Stormy Warren, apparently, in 97, was hired to videotape us in this bar. I don't know what the connection was, but he sent a whole show just recently to Keith. It's like an hour and a half of us in this bar, maybe longer, a couple sets actually. And just raw, man. This bar was not nice. It was a little rough, but it became kind of our home base. We'd play there every week. And it got, you know, it started out like the videos that I put on my Instagram, it was still kind of early on. So you could see like there was hardly anybody in the crowd. You can hear a little smattering of applause, but then the word got out. And it became really popular. And then Kix Brooks and Ronnie Dunn, they came to the show and literally sit on the floor right in front of us. And these looking guys up. Were big stars at this point. And they were just so blown away, I guess, by the fact that we were just a trio, super high energy. Keith was just, you know, he's Keith. He was Keith then.
That's
just like
the thing is these videos that you're posting on your Instagram, the thing that's most, like, maybe mind-blowing about them is how developed Keith is.
Yeah.
And this is almost 30 years ago, right?
Yeah. Like, almost 30 years
roughly,
ago.
Roughly, yeah. And he's kind of like Keith. He's maybe a little bit rawer, but...
Yeah.
But
a little more country. We're both playing a little higher. Our guitars are up here.
You play your bass so low.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it. It's so cool, though. It's such a good look, isn't it?
I don't know why I do it.
But do you do it because you know it looks cool? Like, that's why you got to do it, right? Because it looks cool, right?
Yeah. Now I can't play with it any other way. But
really?
Actually, it's higher now than what it used to be. I was writing last week with Jared Keim and Ryan Beaver. We were talking about this John Mayer Crossroads we did. And we were watching the video, and I actually, after that video, I had to raise it up. I remember because my hands were going completely numb during the show.
Yeah, right,
it's so low.
That'll happen. Yeah,
yeah. I don't know why the hell I do it. It's just
But going back to these early days.
Yeah.
So the thing that is weird to me that I've heard you talk about in a lot of interviews is that Keith was so, you know, like weird for the time. He had long hair. He had earrings.
Yeah.
But to me, this is so funny because while I believe that to be true, people didn't just look at him and go, oh my God, this guy's like so hot. He's like a rock star. The music's incredible. Like they really were blocked. They couldn't get it. Like they couldn't see it.
Yeah, because at that point, you know, Garth was ruling the world. So it was, you know, a lot more like Texas.
Hat acts, like
Oklahoma country where you know, the big flame shirts and the hats. And Keith just didn't look like that, man. I mean, he had earrings all up and down his ear, even though his music was really country. If you listen to that record, like, it's country. It's chicken picking stuff. Incredible.
It's probably more country than the stuff he's doing now. 100%. Or more traditional country. Yeah.
100%. Yeah, he's just grown and changed so much over the years, you know. But it freaked people out. And the fact we were a trio, nobody was doing that either. So it was just
was that like were you guys trying to be the Police, or like why did you think about bringing in?
It was probably
just money that you just couldn't, like, there was no room for anyone else to tour with you guys.
No, there's no room in the van.
Yeah. And why do you think it didn't work? Because the record label shelved the album and they weren't pushing it, or were there other reasons that it just didn't connect? Like,
no, I think it would have, because there's songs on there that would have been hits, I think.
Oh,
if they
100%.
Were pushed. I mean, there's songs on there that will be hits right now.
That somebody could cut.
Oh, right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually
Some
said
Love
this
could
Keith.
Be a hit.
Yes, just
right
Some
now.
Love.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a song called Hank Don't Fail Me Now. If Morgan Wallen cut that song right now, it would crush.
Yes.
Crush. And I've told him that recently, but, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, that would be cool. But,
I think Ghost of My Guitar is killer. I don't know if that would be a big hit today, because it's sort of like a deep cut, but I think the playing on that song is
so
awesome
good too.
Yeah.
Every song is great on that record.
It's actually every song is great on that record.
Yeah.
You got to listen to this record. It's fantastic.
He and a guy named Vernon Rust wrote all those songs. And there's a couple outside cuts, like Some Days You Gotta Dance that the Chicks ended up doing on their record after that. But mostly it's him and Vernon Russ wrote all these incredible songs.
Right.
Incredible songs.
So you toured, so after the ranch breaks up, you then toured with the Dixie Chicks for 2 years on the Fly Tour.
Yes.
And then basically they went super bluegrass. And you always say that you just weren't a bluegrass guy.
Uh-uh.
You couldn't learn upright. Did you attempt to learn upright?
I tried.
Because you were like, fuck, I got to keep this gig.
I
gotta
tried,
learn how to play upright.
Way behind the game at that point, you know.
Did they give you the opportunity, though?
Yeah.
They said, hey, see if you can learn upright.
Yeah.
And we'll keep you around, basically.
Yeah. And you don't just learn how to play bluegrass upright. You are born into that world.
Yeah.
You know, those guys, I grew up kind of born into the rock world with Van Halen and Ozzy and Kiss and that kind of stuff. Van Halen was my absolute favorite. But then I moved into the R&B stuff when I was a teenager, Stevie Wonder and Prince. But I just never listened to bluegrass. It just was not popular where we grew up, even though we grew up in a totally country area.
Michael Anthony's not playing upright.
No.
There's no way.
I don't think so. I never saw him. So when it came time for them to do that record and then, you know, to go on tour, like, you can't just become that. Those guys are that.
They're born. They start playing so young. Oh. I think it's the only way to get that real bluegrass
100%.
Feel. It's the only
100%.
Way. Yeah.
So I lost that gig, unfortunately.
So then you've talked about how there was like a 2 year period where you couldn't get a gig.
Nothing.
And which to me is sort of like were you going insane?
Yes.
During that time?
Yeah.
And
I thought, oh, it's done.
Did you think that was, how old were you? Under 30?
So what year was that? 2000? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was about 30.
We were just talking about you're about to go celebrate your mom's 80th birthday.
Yeah.
Like, were your parents sort of like, what are you doing? Like, you just spent 5 years in a band not doing anything. Then maybe the Dixie Chicks gig gave them a little hope that you know, he could do this.
Oh, yeah, I'd made it at that point.
But then 2 years in, isn't that like...
It was rough.
That was rough, right?
I mean, I was playing little shows here and there with my friend Jed Hughes, a guy named Keith Gaddis. We would go out and play some shows, but no real money.
And were you just itching to play? Like, when I don't have a gig, it's like, oh, I just want to get out and play. For the gig, just because, like, I want to play
horrible.
A gig.
It was horrible. Like, I went through a serious depression because I thought, it's done. Like, I'm done.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I thought, maybe people, because I came off that Chicks gig, and it was the Fly Tour, the last, because I did 3 tours with them, and the Fly Tour was the last one we did. And they were the biggest thing there was at that point.
Yeah.
And so I thought, maybe people think I'm too expensive. I don't know. I wasn't at that point. But it was a weird, weird time, man. And so then I decided, okay, well, I'm just going to do this myself. And then my brother and I, with our friend John Dedrick, we did a band, like a rock band, wrote all the stuff. Actually, it's a really good record we made. Came close, got a lot of label interest, you know, went to LA, got people into it, but it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And then I guess it was maybe late 04, I got a call from my friend who played drums with the Chicks, Jim Bogus, who was now in the Counting Crows.
Yeah, and he brings you into that
band. He brings
me
into that kind of world. Yeah.
And your brother, too, played for Meatloaf.
Yeah.
Would he play all the Todd Rundgren parts? Like, is that what he would do? Like,
shoot, I'm not sure.
But he would...
Because there's two guitar players.
Those are heavy guitar parts. Oh, especially on Bat Out Hell. Like, those are massive guitar parts to fill.
My brother is serious. Brother is serious.
Oh, my God. So, okay. Yeah. So, but here's the thing that blows my mind, which to me is so great, is, like, you don't have a gig for 2 years, and then all of a sudden you have, like, 4 gigs on the table.
In 1 week. Yeah.
And so Keith calls you, but then who else calls you?
Dwight Yoakam. Yeah.
So to me, Keith was probably not a superstar. Here you haven't worked for 2 years, and Dwight Yoakam's calling you, probably going to pay you pretty decently.
Yeah, probably.
And you said, screw that, I'm going with Keith.
Yeah, I mean.
What did he offer you?
He offered me the job. We didn't even talk money because I.
But not even money. Like, what did he say the job was, is what I mean.
He just kept saying to me, because he's from Kentucky, I'm from West Virginia. He was like, hillbilly music is born in our soul. Because I know from my friend that was playing with him that he literally will call out something from the 40s and 50s, that's random, crazy stuff. Oh, yeah. On stage, boom, you got to know it. You got to know hundreds of these songs. And he kept saying, you know all these songs. I'm like, I don't know these songs. Like, you call out something from Van Halen 2, I'm in.
I'm ready to go.
Yeah, but
people say that to me sometimes. Isn't that funny? People say, oh, you got to know this song. Let's play it right now. I'm like, why would I know this random song from the 70s or whatever? And a lot of them I do, but I'm like, why would you assume that I know this song? I don't know this song.
Again, you have to be born into that world, because Keith Gaddis was playing guitar for him at the time, and he was that guy. Like, he knew all those songs. And so I thought about it, and even though having a legend call my phone and offer me this gig and talk for me, he talked to me for maybe 2 hours. I had to call him the next day and leave a message just saying, thank you so much, but I'm just not the right guy for you. Then the Counting Crows, I think I could have kept going with that, because we were just doing, I did the Oscars and different shows with them. And then Chris Cagle called me, and then Keith, Chris McHugh, that was playing drums with Keith, called me and asked me if I would come back with Keith. And I just knew in my gut. And I made the right decision.
Oh, my God.
Does
that ever haunt you when you think about that? You could have gone out with Dwight.
Yeah.
And you would have had a totally different path. Now, it could have been great,
completely different path. But being with Keith opened up so many other doors. The songwriting doors were opened up because of him. I mean, still to this day, man, doors are open because of him. Because of that gig, because people see us live and just feel something that you wouldn't normally feel in a concert, because he's so damn good, and it's just a lot of opportunities have come because of that.
What was the gig like back then? Because I feel like from my adult life, Keith has always been doing arenas, but that can't be the case, right? It had to be.
No, when I came in, I think he was maybe a year away from arenas. I know the very first show I did with him was the Houston Rodeo. Then we did like the Ryman, places like that. And we were playing big clubs and I think opening for some big people. And then he had his first big headline tour, maybe 06, maybe. Yeah. And so that was fun.
Oh, like, my God.
Yeah. I actually had coffee yesterday with Chris Rodriguez, who was the guitar player in Keith's band at that point. You know, legend guy. He's played with Kenny Loggins and all these different people. And we had coffee yesterday. I haven't seen him in years. And we were talking about that time, that band at that time. It was on fire, man. It was so good.
Yeah.
We just 5-6 dudes on stage just going for it.
Just absolutely ripping it.
Oh, yeah. So good.
I've got some songs here that have not been in the set list for a while. Mm. You're very involved in this.
Oh, yeah.
You are very involved in the set list and the band. These are just some observations I have of songs that I would be in my perfect Keith Urban set list. I'm just going to throw them out there and do whatever you want with them. First of all, my favorite Keith Urban song that I haven't seen in the set list for years Even the Stars Fall for You.
Oh,
off
wow.
of Fuse.
Oh, yeah.
Could that make it the set list? Or maybe. Do you think the fans even want to hear that? Am I the only one who like cares about this song?
No, I think that would work. It's so tempo. It's great. But it's funny. Like, we actually will forget. We'll have these conversations about what to do, and then we'll just completely forget about songs like that.
Yeah.
Like, because he's had so many that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. That's a great one, though. That would rock.
You guys did that at an award show, right? At ACM Awards?
Yeah, I think
once.
So.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody wants to hear that song, but to me, I would kill to see you guys play that live.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That whole thing. There's a great guitar solo in that song, too.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Next song right here, Who Wouldn't Want to Be Me?
Oh,
which
yeah.
to me feels like a standard. That hasn't been the set list.
Mm-mm.
Why is that? That has to be intentional, right? To be like...
No,
like there's just so many songs you can't
fit
them all in.
We played that. We've actually played that a couple times in the past year and a half. I don't know why we forget about that. Like it's crazy. Like he wants to do like a real combo of his classics and some
right.
of the newer stuff. And sometimes you just run out of time.
Yeah, right.
He's got so many, but. See, that's another good one.
That to me,
I'm right there with you on that.
That to me is like a great like second song in a set. Like
yeah.
you start out big and then you come in with the groove of that. That's got to be back in the set. I mean, don't take your advice from me, but
well,
I'm saying I want to see that in the show.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Okay. Oh yeah. No. What were you gonna say?
Well, I was gonna say in Vegas this past year we did a residency. We brought back Better Life. We hadn't played that in years and years and years and years. And we brought that back in song two on the set.
Yeah.
And it had that effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
You guys labor over the set list, right? You're
oh
constantly changing them.
Constantly.
And does your lighting
yeah.
team want to kill you guys?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And do they get the set list in advance, basically, or
yeah,
or
but
no?
We sound check for long periods of time. And so we change things all
yeah.
the time. I mean, he'll watch shows from the night before, like game tape, like you know, quarterbacks watch game tape, coaches watch game tape, and he just sees like little moments. It's like, oh no, we got to go into this 2 seconds faster, that kind of thing. He's a master at it.
And when you rehearse yeah. the band, is that because that's kind of your role, right?
I mean, we're all in it. He's always there. Like he's
okay. Yeah, yeah.
It's not like because there are many singers that don't even show up.
Until the last day or whatever, the
yeah,
band's
yeah,
fully rehearsed.
The band's
or,
fully rehearsed.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
there is
That's
none
not
of
it.
That.
No. Yeah.
He is the band. Like, he's so involved in every single decision. Yeah, there's no sound checks where we're doing it without him. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Like, because we'll do sound check for an hour, hour and a half, and then he will sound check. We leave the stage, and he will stay up there. Sometimes for another hour,
sure
2 hours.
Sure, support loves that, right?
He just cares so much about
what
he
is he
does.
Sound checking? His guitar?
His guitar.
Tone?
Oh, yeah.
Is he playing real amps right now, or is he?
Yes.
Because there was a window in there where he was doing.
Small window where he did the fractal. He might still have a fractal in there somewhere, too, but he's definitely, I think he was bringing back some old school stuff this year. He changes it up. Constantly.
All the time.
He and John Mayer will talk, and then next thing you know,
there's some kind of new amp
that's coming in.
Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But have you been playing the same rig for a long time?
Yes. I have no idea how to even set it up.
I don't even know what. Is your tech just shows up and mm-hmm. does it, basically?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a moment where we did a rehearsal at SIR here in town, and my tech couldn't be there. And so I showed up and I had all my speakers, my amps, and there was just a bunch of cables sitting on top of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And they actually, one of the band guys has a picture of me just staring at it. Because, like, I don't even know.
It's like Dwight Yoakam calling you
yeah.
and saying, you know these
you
songs,
know
right?
Song, like,
it's like, no, you know how to turn this rig on, right?
I don't even know where that plug goes.
I
have no idea.
Yeah.
It's gotten, I mean, maybe it's not complicated, but I don't know how to
figure
set
out.
It up.
I saw this show years ago where they played South by Southwest, and you were on the gig. And they said that you were having emergency heart surgery
oh, yeah.
or something.
Yeah,
so they put you in the tracks,
yes.
which to me seems crazy that they had enough
yeah.
footage from or they had enough audio
well,
from
our
the
guy,
shows.
Our sound man records every night, and it's all individual tracks. So if something like that happens, he can bring it in.
And how does that work? He just flies?
He just flew a show in. I mean, they can't break it down. Well, actually, they can do it with our track guy, Jeff Linsenmeyer. He's able to manipulate things and pause things and then kick
right.
it back in again. So yeah, there was 10 weeks where I was out.
And what happened?
They just used my tracks.
No, but what happened to you? Were you okay or?
Oh yeah, I mean I've had two open heart surgeries.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the first one was in 06. I just had a heart murmur all my life. Yeah, it was no big deal. And then 06, I went in. I was feeling a little weird, and they called me the next day and said, "You have 2 months to get open valve replacement surgery, or you face imminent death."
And you go, "Get me in today."
And I went, "Well, I do like living, so."
Living is a big part of this
whole
thing.
Let's do this. Yeah. And so then the same thing happened in 2018. Like, it was a freak thing. Like, the threads came loose on that. So I had to do the whole thing again.
Oh, my God.
But I recovered so much faster the second time, which is odd because I was a lot older. But my now ex-wife, she was so adamant about the way I ate. She would make me eat this stuff called congee, which I'd never even heard of before. She would have that. Some kind of rice kind of thing. I don't know. It's all, I don't know anything about it. It's not Southern food. I know that. But it's, she had me eat it every single day and had acupuncturist come to the house. And then 10 weeks after the surgery, I was on stage gone. But the first surgery took me 4 months to recover.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't miss any gigs that first one, though, because Keith ended up. The same time ended up going to rehab and got clean during that time. So he needed all that time to get clean and to stay sober, and which he's been sober ever since.
When he came out of rehab, did you notice a huge performance increase in his playing?
He just everything about him. Because you can look and see, because I went through the same thing. I went to rehab in 2010. You can see his eyes, like there's pictures of him during that time beforehand. We've actually joked about it because I saw a picture of him at an award show kind of close to that era, but like before he went to get clean, and you could just see it in his eyes. I just joked, I said, someone's about to go to rehab, because he was just going through it, man. He was living hard, and but yeah, he cleaned his act up in 06 and has been clean ever since. He's helped tons of people get sober.
Did he help you go to rehab?
Yes. Yeah, he got me into Betty Ford. Yeah. And when I called him, because I had a little intervention done on me by some folks, I called him to tell him about it. He just said, yeah, I've been waiting for the call. He knew, but he was not one of those guys who was going to push it, because he knows, like, if you don't want to...
It's not going to work.
Nah, if you don't want to get sober, you're not going to... It's not going to happen.
Right, right.
So he was waiting for me to make that decision, and then he called people and got me in.
It's good to have someone to do that, right?
100%.
That's
a good man. A good man.
And now, is it a completely dry crew? Like, I've heard this about. Is that not true?
Mm-mm.
Or no? Like, someone could have a beer on stage if they want
of course.
One of the band members.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think it was soon after he got out of rehab. I remember he had a party at the house. He and Nicole had a party, had a dinner party, and there was, you know, there was definitely everybody else was drinking, but because he's not. He doesn't think like, oh, since I quit, everyone else has
everyone
to quit.
Else should,
that's
yeah,
his
yeah.
That's his problem. That's his stuff to deal with. He's never pushed that on anybody. So he's never told anybody in the crew they can't have a beer or anything. You know, as long as you do your job and show up and do your job in a, you know,
that's
in
the
highest,
yeah.
you know, professional way, that's all he cares about. And same with me. Like, I'm around it all the time now. I don't even think about it. It's
right.
Yesterday it was 11 years I've been sober, because I had a little bump after I went to the rehab in 2010. I had a little, I fell off the wagon for about a year. So yesterday was 11 years I've been sober. But
oh man.
Again, like.
Yesterday was.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
But you can't be in this business and not be around it. You have to learn to just get over it, you know? And
I don't drink either, but people always say, like, how do you do it? And I feel like it's actually not that hard, but you're just always around it. Yeah, yeah.
Always
but,
around it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in our dressing room every single day. I could care less.
Yeah.
You know? And the guys in our band, they can have drinks. None of them, like, lose their shit over it. They just have drinks. They have fun, go out and play the show, and that's it. Like, they're responsible with it, so... I don't think.
Yeah, that's all.
That's just on them. And Keith has never said a word to anybody about that kind of stuff. Ever.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. How do you guys travel between, like, if you have a gig on a Friday and a Saturday, will you fly to that gig or will you bus?
Most
are you ever busing anymore?
We actually bust not too long ago because Keith was coming from another thing. He was with Nicole at a shoot. So he was coming straight from that gig. So we bust. But that's pretty rare now. The last big tour we did, we would fly in with him on a Thursday, and we'd bus, all of us would bus on Friday, then go home on Saturday. So we're gone for 2 days, basically.
Right. Whole band basically travels together with Keith.
Yes.
When possible.
Yes. Yeah, which is 98% of the time.
Yeah.
That's a game changer, my man. You compare that to the van.
It's good.
Life is good.
But even like flying, like, because you guys probably fly private, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is the best gig ever.
Oh, my God.
What happened a couple of years ago? I saw on Instagram there was some festival that the weather was bad and it was late and you guys landed somewhere.
That was during when I was out with the heart surgery.
Were you not in that when it was Keith and Danny Radar and everyone got into an Uber?
They
and
got
went
into
to the
an
gig.
Uber and drove probably an hour or two because they had to go to another city
because of the
storm and got in a little
Uber. I thought you were there. You weren't there for that? That was the funniest thing
ever.
Oh,
my God. It was amazing.
And imagine that Uber driver, Keith Urban, gets in the car.
I'm not sure the driver even knew who he was, but that was a funny one. And totally real, too, because it was the only option.
Yeah.
They had no other option to get to the show. They got there right on time, got on stage, played, and then left.
We've got to talk about your songwriting, too, but quickly, have you guys... I've heard you talk about wanting to play Japan. Do you think Keith Urban could play Japan?
I don't know, but that's our dream. That's our dream gig.
Why not just go try one? Why not just book something? And I guess it's so expensive, right, to get all the way over there?
Yeah, I'm sure. And I don't know if he has a fan base there or not. You know, it might go over great. I think they would love him because they love guitar players.
Yes.
That would be a fun one.
How do you do it? Like, what's going to have to happen?
I'm assuming you're going to call management and say...
Can I do that?
Yes.
What am I going to say? I was just with Jerry Flowers, and we're dying to get over to Japan.
Yeah.
Why would we not do this? This seems... If you're playing the airport, it's a quick trip to just get on a plane. You're already at
the
airport.
We're at the gate.
You're already at the airport. Yeah. Just get to...
We can go there maybe even before we get on the plane, put out a tip jar.
Raise money.
Get a little cash. That'll pay for the tickets for the crew members. And then go over there and play.
Why is that meaningful to you? Because you grew up listening to like Live at Budokan like Kiss and they were all playing these epic gigs in Japan.
100%.
And it's just like crazy, right?
100%. I would look at those album covers like Kiss in Japan and just it just seemed like such a magical world. Cheap Trick, Live at Budokan, that was another one too.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It just seems like that's the ultimate.
If you can,
ultimate goal.
I feel like Aerosmith did a big Japan tour, right?
They all did.
Okay, I feel like this is coming. I want to see this happen.
Well, thanks to you, it's going to happen now.
I really hope so. No, I hope thanks to me, we have Even the Stars Fall for You in the set.
Yes.
One gig. I don't know. Probably not. So obviously you're a massive songwriter too, in addition to being the band leader, Keith's band. You had a song on Morgan's album.
Yeah.
Last Drive Down Main.
Yeah.
When you have it, most people always say, like, unless the song is a single, you don't really get that much money for an album cut.
Now you don't because of streaming.
Right. Yeah. But on that Morgan album, which streams so well, do you end up doing okay with that song?
I don't know yet. I haven't gotten paid yet.
It's too early.
It's too early. It's probably coming. I'll probably start seeing something.
Yeah.
But, I would imagine that would be pretty good.
That you'll see something for.
That, yeah. Just the fact that he is singing on something that, you know, me and Ryan Hurd and Michael Lawton wrote. He cut it like a week after we wrote it too. Just the fact that you hear that voice, that's pretty good.
How did you get him the song? He cut it a week after.
Yeah, I think my publisher Travis Myatt sent it to Sarah Canapi, who was kind of, she's not working for the label, but she was kind of hired to look for songs, and she sent it to his producer, I think, and he loved it, and then sent it straight to Morgan.
So she sent it to Joey Moy, basically, and he goes, "Oh, this is great."
Yeah, I mean, it was about a week, maybe a week and a half after we wrote it.
It is a great song.
It's
got a great riff in it, like great
awesome.
Feeling to it. How much did the demo sound like the finished version?
Pretty close. Yeah. The riff is the riff's the same. The main riff that I came up with is the same, but then they just added a couple different things that were a little different, but. But that voice, though, man. Ooh.
Sounds great on that record.
You can't... I don't know if there's much better.
Is that the fastest you've ever gotten a song written and pitched and cut?
Yeah.
In like a week?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely the fastest.
Yeah. And then you had the Outskirts title track from Sam Hunt.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible song too.
It's just now starting to catch fire.
You think? Yeah.
Yeah, it's starting to do really well now. It was put out in July, I think, of last year, and just sat there. It didn't do anything, like nothing. And I was actually told at the Christmas party for 12-6, my publishing company, Sam's brother, Van Hunt, was there. Cool name for a cool guy.
Van Hunt, it's a great name.
Yeah, yeah. He told me at that party, he's like, no, it's done. It's just not going to go anywhere. I was like, okay. So I had to let go of that because I knew that song's a hit. Like, I just knew. And somehow, I think his manager, Sam's manager, Brad Blanchet, went in there and just started
working,
raising it. Hell, and just like, we got to do something here. And it's caught fire now. It might be top 10 next week.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's working.
And it came out, last year? March last year, roughly?
Yeah. It was streaming for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think it was streaming so well, they convinced me to make it the
same. They brought it to radio, yeah.
Yes.
Do you consider yourself part of that camp? Because you've had, you've had a handful of songs. Kinfo.
Yeah. You never know, but I might have his next one too.
Yeah.
We have a song called Locked Up that's just awesome.
Yeah.
I'm excited about this.
Do you consider yourself in the Sam Hunt camp?
Yeah.
Or like a little bit for the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because every single time that he does something,
he calls you.
Yeah. I'm the up tempo guy for him, definitely.
Yeah.
Even though Outskirts is not really. I guess it is. Kind of is. I don't know. But House Party, those kind of vibes, Kinfolks is a little more at tempo than he normally does, and that's kind of my wheelhouse, so I come in for that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And so when you're doing that, because I've heard you say that you're usually like the groove guy.
Yeah.
You consider yourself less of a lyrics person.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes, but I'm
you can still bang out a lyric.
Yeah.
Don't sell him short. He'll bang out a lyric.
I wrote one last week with this young artist, Bryce Leatherwood.
Who is that? I don't even know what that is.
I think he was on The Voice. Best country name ever.
Bryce
Leatherwood. He's a great, great young guy. He's like 24 years old. He is definitely like throwback 90s country. His voice is the real deal from Georgia. But that song we wrote with Jared Kime and Ryan Beavers, who just had their first number one with Warren Zeiders a couple weeks ago, which is super exciting for those dudes. But I actually came in with a whole chorus written, lyrics and the melody, which is rare for me. I usually, I'll have titles, that kind of thing, but I'll usually stick to the melody and the
feel, right.
Especially with Sam, because he's one of the greatest lyricists out there.
Does he drive you crazy with how much he edits? Like, does he bring you into that process?
No.
No,
I mean, he just wants it. He wants it right, so he takes the time. Like sometimes, a year or two per song, he'll do multiple versions of it, just because he just wants it to be right, and the final product is usually amazing. Not usually, always. He's just so damn good at what he does. But he edits like someone edits a book they're writing. He doesn't do it in. The normal time we do it here in Nashville, 11 to 3 usually.
Right.
No, he doesn't work like that.
But does he get all the will he ever call you back to a song? Like on Kinfolk, did he ever call you back past the initial day when you wrote the main song? Does he ever call you back and say, we need to get together and work on this a little bit? Or is he doing most of that on his own?
I think he's doing that on his own, or he's calling Josh Osborne, his guy. They work together and everything.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, he does different versions. I've told the story before on Kinfolks. When I heard it on the radio first time, the second verse was completely different than I had a week and a half earlier.
Yeah.
Not just like kind of different. Every word was different. Yes. And his other verse was amazing.
Yeah.
But he just had a gut feeling. He's like, this is not right.
He just goes with it.
He goes with it, and he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a man who... He should be an example for all young artists out there, because he, from the very beginning, when he got his first record deal, because a lot of people are intimidated by that. They're intimidated by producers, or they're intimidated by label A&R people to get told what they're supposed to be. That was not him. That guy, from the very beginning, said, this is how it is, this is who I am, and this is how we're going to roll.
And it worked for him.
It worked for him.
Of course.
I think that's why it worked for him, because he knew who he was as an artist, you know, and he stuck to it, and he didn't get intimidated by any of those guys.
Yeah.
And so, which is rare. But that, to me, is like, that's an example of what a young artist
do. How do you do that, though? To me, it's so like...
Oh, it'd be scary.
Because it's like they're dangling the keys, and then there's artists in town that you can tell just kind of phoned in, and they still have success. And it's like, that's a path too. And you can still do okay.
Sure.
If you just do what the label says. But sometimes the label doesn't know.
No.
It's all a gamble.
No one knows. Yeah. It's still amazing anytime a song ever even comes out. Because every time there's a hit, everyone's like pretty jazzed about it. Because we all know in our gut that we don't know what the hell we're doing.
Yeah, right, right.
We don't know what's going to connect.
Yeah.
You know, what we think might connect, you put it out there and it bombs, you know?
Yeah, right.
So... there's no telling, but he knew who he was, and he stuck to it, and it worked for him.
Did you see him at the Bridgestone show?
No.
I didn't go either. I wanted to, but I couldn't go.
No, I had my little girls that night, so I couldn't. Couldn't go.
Do they think we were doing this cool? Are they old enough to kind of know and get that? Like, have they been to any shows yet or anything?
No, they're 2 and 4. So, I started a little late in life. No, they've seen me on TV. Yeah. My oldest. Belle, who's 4, she'll be 5 in May. She thinks it's cool, and she'll have me play, you know, the recordings over and over again.
Yeah.
But when I try to sing at the house in front of them,
they're like,
know,
"Shut up, Dad!"
Oh no, they yell at me. They don't like it at all.
What is the thing? Keith Urban Live is one of my favorite country acts. Maybe probably one of my favorite country acts ever.
Yeah.
I've seen you guys probably 3 or 4 times.
Oh wow.
I get such a high feeling seeing you guys play. It's like the energy.
I feel that way too.
Do you feel that way on stage?
100%.
Is that why I feel that way? Because I see you feeling like that.
It ain't fake.
And it's contagious.
It ain't fake.
What is it? Is it him sort of being the band leader and bringing that energy?
He just loves what he does so much, and he's so good at it.
Yeah.
And after all these years, you would think I wouldn't be impressed anymore because I've seen it all with him.
But still, like.
Still blown away.
Yeah.
Still blown away.
Do you get that? Like when I listen to him, sometimes I'll hear him just hit a chord, and every note will sound so good and ring out.
Mm.
And I'll go, "How does he do that?" Do you get that feeling too?
100%.
Where it's like, God, that's the best sound G chord I've ever heard in my life. Yeah. Right? Like
I hear from fans all the time say that. They say, like, "You guys seem like you have so much fun up there. Like you're really enjoying it." It's like, it's because we are.
Yeah,
it's real. And that's why it's so successful. That's why he still to this day. Sell so many tickets is because people leave that concert feeling amazing, you know. Like he says it to him, like, whatever's going on outside, that ain't happening in here tonight.
Yeah,
and it's true. It's really true. Like it's genuine, man.
Yeah,
yeah.
I heard you say in an interview that sometimes you have to work on, or maybe not work on, but sometimes you think about managing your ego because you're up there being a rock star. Yeah. And sometimes, I don't know, and you have so many number one hit songs, and it's like you have to think about, maybe I need to manage my ego. You seem like a pretty egoless guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, we're all, there's no doubt about it, we all have egos. Or anybody in this business who's successful in it has pretty
some
big
kind of
egos,
ego,
or you wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Like, this is a funny thing. Because someone that interviewed Keith from Australia, this was, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, was saying, "Mate, did you ever think you'd get to this point?" And he went, "Yeah, that's why I'm here."
right.
He
of
knew
that
you have to know. You have to feel some kind of ego, like, and feel good about yourself. But then we're also super, like, I don't know, like, everybody that I know in this business is still, like, scared little puppies, too. Like, always thinking, like, are we good enough? So I go through that time where we're on stage, we feel
the best.
Super strong, 10 feet tall. But then there's other times where I'm scared to death up there, too.
Really?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Depending on the setting or just same setting, different night, you might have that feeling. Yeah, yeah.
I don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
Just insecurities kick in. You know, I'm not a young guy anymore in this business. And you think, like, do they think I'm old? And which, you know, we don't feel old. You know, we don't feel our age. We don't feel any different than we did in our 20s. I know all of us in the band. But we still... You still think that sometimes. And the songwriting thing definitely is, like, I doubt myself all the time in that business. Even though, like, I have to stop sometime and go, oh, no, I've done all right. And I'm still doing all right. I'm still in it for some reason.
Yeah, 100%.
But it's still like I go through those times where I'm definitely.
And you try taking it in because you're like, I'm in it now, but 5 years, well, I don't know what's going to be happening or whatever.
You never
like,
know.
Yeah, you never
I
know.
Mean, I'll be 52 in a couple weeks, and that's not a young man in this business, you know?
Yeah, but don't you think it's funny that, like, if you look at the last 20 years of who had the best touring, now we're in a different era with, like, Taylor Swift, but it's like the people who had the best touring was, like, the Stones, like, all the classic rock acts.
Yeah, right.
And they were even older. They were in their 60s and 70s when they were selling all those tickets. It's
no,
like,
it's still possible.
Yeah.
It's just you get in your head sometimes. I don't know if Mick Jagger ever gets in his head about that. But maybe. I don't know.
I bet he does. I don't
probably.
Know.
Yeah, I mean, he's 83 and still crushing it.
He's
still
kicking it. Oh, my God. Like, I'm dying to see him this year. They got tour dates out.
Oh, man, that new album is
awesome. Can you go to a show and have a good time? Like, who would you have a good time at?
Man, I haven't seen one in so long.
Yeah.
The last show I think I saw where I paid for tickets and went, actually drove to Kentucky to see him was Justin Timberlake. On the Suit and Tie tour. Is that what it was called? Suit and Tie? Yeah. That was awesome.
Why'd you go that? You were just a big fan? You just thought you wanted to get to see that?
Well, there was a tour that Prince did in 2004 where he started playing all his hits again.
Yeah.
And I went to four or five shows of that tour, like flew to different cities to see him. Because
you're a massive Prince fan.
He's the greatest performer I'd ever seen in my life. And I noticed that every one of those shows, I saw Justin Timberlake on the side of the stage. He didn't get up. He didn't perform ever. But every single one of those shows, he was on the side of the stage watching Prince, learning from the master.
Yeah.
And then that tour that I saw, he had a lot of Prince's band guys with him in his band.
So that's why it seemed cool to go see that show.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was awesome.
Is it weird? Like, I was at Billy Joel at Nissan Stadium. Maybe that was like 6 months ago now. Mm. Or that was like a while ago. And I happened to be with like a really big country artist who had played Nissan Stadium. And I said, is it weird to think that out of everyone in the stadium, you're the only one probably in the audience who's
actually been up there? Yeah.
Like, is that a weird feeling? He was like, yeah, I guess that is kind of weird. Like, do you ever think that when you see an arena, you're probably one of the only people who's actually played an arena?
Yeah, you know how the sausage is made, basically. But it's still fun to see. But I just rarely do it because when most people are playing, that's when we're playing. And when I'm home,
the last thing you want to do is go out and see a show or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have my little girls a lot during the week, and I don't know why. I just want to stay home. And, again, I don't go out and party anymore, so it's just not really that scene for me. So I like staying in.
Yeah.
You know?
Would you see the Sammy Hagar, Joe Satriani tour that's happening right now?
I mean, I would.
With Michael Anthony.
I would.
Yeah. Do you think he's the right guitar player for... To fill in for Van Halen?
I mean, I don't think any guitar player is the right person to fill in.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I've been going on a tear again listening to those old Van Halen records.
Oh, my God.
It's
even the Van Hagar stuff is great. Oh. Do you like that phase? Or you think David Lee Roth is the...
Dave, to me, was the best. But as far as a singer, Sammy is a much better singer. Yeah. He was one of the best rock singers out there.
Did you get too sentimental, though, in the Sammy Hagar days?
The lyrics are much different. Yeah. But I still love it. I mean, we were actually supposed to open for Van Halen.
Really?
Two shows. They were doing an arena, a stadium tour. And then maybe 3-4 weeks before we were supposed to open, which I was super excited about. I couldn't even imagine meeting him.
Yeah.
Then they had to cancel because Eddie had mouth cancer, I think.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That breaks my heart.
Oh, it breaks my heart. When he died, like, I cried. Because my brother and I, it was borderline obsession with that man when we were kids. Yeah, I just wanted anything. I just would stare at those album covers, just wanting to be them so much. And Michael Anthony, to me, was such a great bass player. And I found him on Instagram, and I wrote him this very long letter about what he meant to me. I didn't hear back, but he probably gets tons of those, but... I was actually glad I did it. I did that for him and a guy named Daryl Jones where I just laid it all out and just
Daryl Jones is, I remember watching Stones videos as a kid.
Yeah.
And just obsessing over everything about Daryl Jones.
He was my number one guy.
That's right. But he was playing with Sting. You found him on the early Sting records.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
He was on those like early Sting records.
Yeah. And then he was also with Miles Davis before that, but when he was 18, but then he played with Peter Gabriel and Madonna, and then he went to the Stones. But he was my guy that I based my whole career around still to this day, because he's a great bass player, but he looked cool as hell.
He looks so cool.
Yes. And a lot of bass players don't think about that stuff.
Yeah.
They just kind of play up and they just kind of sit there and don't do much. But he was like super fun to watch.
Yeah.
And I figured out at a young age that people see music much more than they hear it.
Yeah.
Especially live. So if you act like you're a badass, then most people think you're a badass. Yeah.
But so, you play your bass so low, which to me is like a punk ethos. But yeah. But you don't really mention punk as being having that big of an influence.
No, it wasn't. I think later on in life, I started getting into a little bit more raw kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I was definitely more. But Daryl, I don't know if he didn't play low, did he?
No, he plays kind of medium. Right? Yeah. He just looks great whenever
he does.
He
just looks awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He just looks awesome.
Here's the point. Point is, Jerry Flowers, are you going back on the road anytime soon with Keith? Does he have any dates coming up?
Oh, yeah. We're playing. Actually, this is a pretty easy year. We're only doing like 30, 40 shows this year.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll do a lot of festivals this summer. I'm not sure which ones.
You just show up and,
yeah,
and
I look and they say.
And you're ready to rock.
Yeah. Show up here. Yeah.
And you got to listen to his songs that he's written for other artists.
Yes, yes.
We've discussed only a handful of them.
Well, call in if you like Outskirts, because that's the one out right now.
Call in. Right?
Yes.
Let's go. Let's get this to number one.
Yes.
It's climbing.
I'm going to tell you something real quick. I wrote with an artist last week that it was one of the best experiences I've ever had as a songwriter. And seeing this woman in the studio just 2 days ago doing the demo, Hunter Girl, do you know this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is she on BBR too?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
She's crazy, right? She's great.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Unreal. Like, it might have been one of the best songs I've ever written in my career. Just
oh my
me
God.
And her.
Is it going to come out?
I hope. We'll see. We just did the demo. She is insanely
How are we
going to
know
good.
when the song comes out? How are we going to know that it was the song you were talking about?
It's called Wild Things Cry 2. It's a good one, man. But that girl, when I saw her, met her, hanging out with her, like, to me, you think, oh, country music is in good hands. The future is in good hands because that girl is awesome.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the future of country music is in good hands because Jerry Flowers is still out there doing
I'm
it.
Still in it.
He's still in it, playing the shows, writing the songs, mentoring other musicians. We didn't even talk about the fact that he goes out and he is a MD band leader type for other bands. He's done Dustin Lynch. He's done... Yeah. Tons of other artists.
Yeah, and, yeah, Jordan Davis.
Davis.
I put the band together for Morgan Bailey Zimmerman.
Those
so
guys.
I get hired to do that occasionally too. But
yeah.
And also just people hit me up on Instagram and I just go have coffee with them. Young singers. So I dig that. You know, young writers.
Yeah. Or strangers DM you on Instagram to come onto a podcast and you say
true.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm in. Yeah. I'm in all the time. I just like to be around it, man.
Yeah.
So yeah. My Instagram's Jerry Flowers Music. Hit me up and we'll grab a coffee.
I love it. Jerry, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
On a Thursday.
Yep.
Thursday morning. Really appreciate it. This was so fun. And I've always just seen you play for years. I've seen you been playing shows with Keith just in the audience.
Yeah.
And I've just always thought you guys look awesome on stage.
Well, I appreciate it, man.
And everything. So this was awesome.
Thank you.
This was great. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, I loved it.
And we'll do it again.
All
we'll
right.
See you next time.
See ya.
Woo! We got in just in time.
All right.
Yeah.
How we doing?
So the camera.